So, we're exploring the three bodies of the Buddha, the Nyumonikaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Dharmakaya. This morning, Badra gave us a very beautiful and clear evocation of how we can understand the Nyumonikaya. I'm going to start us off in an exploration of the Sambhogakaya this afternoon, which will flow on into our puja this evening, which is very much a sort of Sambhogakaya activity. Don't worry, that will become clear if it's not. And tomorrow, we shall move on into the Dharmakaya with Nyumonikaya. Anyway, I was thinking about how Sambhogakaya is translated. And it's one of the translations is this body as a body of mutual enjoyment. And I said to Pranyamati, like you do, what do you reckon that means then? And we both agreed that we weren't entirely sure. And then somebody else, he said they weren't entirely sure either. It's one of those phrases that you hear, a body of mutual enjoyment. And then last night, after we left the shrine room, I had a most enjoyable time standing in the middle of the courtyard in the rain, looking at the last of the sun on the clouds and the sky and the building. It was just beautiful. I thought there was going to be a rainbow, but there wasn't. But it was very, very beautiful anyway. So I stood there for quite a long time. And then who should come out of the men's community but Suvajra? Now, Suvajra is a venerable being who's been practicing and ordained for many decades, spent many, many years in India, and is very deeply versed and practiced in all things Tibetan, and just he's a very, very wise being. And I said to him, Suvajra, what does Sambhogakaya mean? And he said, well, Bhoga, B-H-O-G-A, means food, nourishment. And apparently in India, you refer to your lunch as your bhoga, as a phrase. And the sam bit means with. So it means sort of nourishment with, or nourishment together. It's like, oh, okay. So we carried on unpacking this a bit more. And there's a phrase that comes up quite a bit in the Pali Canon, which is translated as, feeders on rapture will we be. You may have heard this, but it's a sense of being nourished by rapture and delight in the spiritual and in the transcendental. So we're sort of getting into this territory of there's something in this realm, this Sambhogakaya, that is nourishing, is feeding to us. It feeds our imagination, you could say. But it's... yes, mutual enjoyment. Okay, so what are we talking about here? That's interesting. It's something that arises when two beings or two things come together. And I was thinking, oh, this was me. I then went on to reflect on this. And I was thinking, oh, it's like you've got the Nyumonikaya, you've got the Dharmakaya, and they're kind of meeting together in this middle realm. And it's a realm of beauty. It's sometimes described as the realm of visionary splendour. And it's a kind of beauty that is just very nourishing, inspiring, sustaining. And as I was talking to Suvajra, I said, oh, it's a bit like the Kalyana. We use this word Kalyana as we talk about Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship. This word Kalyana is described as the true, the beautiful, or the good. Kalyana, is this another quality of something that is very nourishing and supporting? And a couple of years ago, I did a very inspiring retreat here with Sadhanandi, exploring Kalyana Mitrata, spiritual friendship. And she described spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, as a space between two people in which the Kalyana can arise. So we've got this, don't pin this down too much, but there's something, all these things we have to sort of feel our way into relationship with, but there's that sense of, there's a space between the kind of down to earth, you know, historical, physical presence of the Buddha, and this really ineffable Dharmakaya blue sky. And in between, there's this space where, in a way, these two realms meet. And what this creates is a kind of visionary splendour. It creates, it's very much the realm where our imagination can come into play. So before I say more about that, just want to say a word about imagination, because it's a very, very important word to understand in the way that Sangharakshita uses it. And it's a word that is probably, I would say, in a lot of ways, quite devalued in our society. We often say it's just imagination, it's only a dream. We might associate imagination with fantasy, with fancy, with something that's kind of actually not so real and not to be valued and not to have weight placed upon it, you could say. It's kind of, there's an essay in Bhante's book, Crossing the Stream, where he talks about the way that actually we've tended to relegate imagination to the realm of entertainment. And we don't actually recognise that it's a very, very powerful and important faculty that we all have. He describes it as a faculty in the sense it's something that is innate in all of us. If we cultivate it and develop it, like any faculty, it can become powerful and effective, or we can neglect it and it may not kind of really be functional in our lives in a way that we're conscious of. Having said that, as I talked about when I did that series of four talks, was it last year, about imagination and the Dharma life, actually we're imagining all the time. But actually we probably don't really realise that. We think it's just the way things are, the way we relate to the world. We're putting our own constructs, interpretations on things all the time. In a way, I remember one of the images I had for it is, if we aren't conscious of our imagination and we use it, we don't use it in a creative way, it's a bit like our imagination will use us. It will start to imagine all sorts of things about all sorts of situations, all sorts of scenarios. It's, in a way, you could say there's a reactive kind of imagination, which is a kind of mental proliferation that's, whoa, you've suddenly imagined, you know, the end of the world and how everything's gone to hell in a handcart before you've, you know, your mind kind of goes off. It's a function of the mind. But actually we can become conscious of our imagination. We can feed our imagination. So this comes back to this word boga, as in samboga kaya. There is a way of engaging the imagination, fascinating the imagination, one might say, with images that can bring us into relationship with these transcendental qualities of the Buddha, with wisdom, with kindness, with energy, a whole raft of the qualities of the enlightened mind, which we can engage with, but we need to have them in a form where we can really come into relationship with them. So we're very familiar with the idea of coming into relationship with each other in the Sangha, and that being a very supportive thing for our practice and spiritual friendship in that way. But we can also come into relationship with the archetypal beings, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that emerged in the Buddhist tradition. And it's not that we're saying they're literally out there like gods. What they are is a kind of crystallization of the qualities of the Buddha into different figures that embody aspects of the enlightened mind. And it's almost like we can befriend them, and actually some of us feel it's almost like they befriend us. So you might feel a connection with Tara, say green Tara, and it might be you chant Tara's mantra, it might be you have an image of green Tara, she's an embodiment of compassion. And actually you might then find actually she starts to come to mind when you're in need of support, or you want to cultivate compassion for someone else, there's a way of, it's a way of training our minds, you could say, but it's much more than that. It's a way of, as I say, feeding and nourishing our imaginations. It's like feeding and nourishing our imaginations with really positive, high quality nourishment. Whereas actually our imaginations are quite, in a way, they're quite ravenous. They'll take in all sorts of things, and we probably feed them with all sorts of things. And you probably know, it's like any kind of diet. If you really reflect on what the effect of your diet is, you really know. And it's like, yeah, if you have a diet of a whole series of, I don't know what it would be, back-to-back box sets after a while. It's a bit like, I remember the feeling used to be when I was a child on Easter Sunday and I really wanted to eat all my Easter eggs. And you get like a... So there's something about this nourishment, this and this intermediary realm which really nourishes our being as we practice. I wanted to mention an interesting quote from Sangharakshita in this respect, thinking about imagination and thinking about culture, because obviously I've been talking about archetypal images specifically of Buddhism, Bodhisattva, sort of within Buddhist culture, but generally, you know, Sangharakshita very much recognises the role of culture in cultivating our imagination in all sorts of ways, whether it is poetry, literature, music, and so on. And there's this lovely aphorism that I remembered of his, which is, culture is like a rainbow bridge that reaches from the material world to the spiritual world. Culture is like a rainbow bridge that reaches from the material world to the spiritual world. And it's quite interesting, there is this association with the Sambhogakāya, with the rainbow, a rainbow body. And it's like the Dharmakāya is very much like the blue sky, the rainbow. The rainbow is, in a way, it's always there and potentially in the blue sky. Sometimes it appears, sometimes it doesn't. But it's something that helps us along the journey to be less identified and attached to the sense of the historical and the literal, and more to move more in the direction of, well, ultimately, what is described as the open dimension of being, shunyata. I mean, sometimes that's translated as emptiness, which is a pretty rubbish translation because of all the associations that we have with that. It's much more this sense of there's this open dimension of being, there's this vast blue sky that is a warm, rich place to dwell, that has limitless possibilities. But we need to understand how to come into relationship with that. And that is the task of our Dharma practice. I want to also say a bit about the role of our practice of puja in relation to this. And we're going to do a puja tonight. But I think before I do that, I might ask Bhadra and Naravira if they've got anything to add to what I've said so far.
Well, of course, got lots to add.
I've got everything to add.
Yeah, but you're the Dharmakāya, so you wouldn't.
You should be the thunderous silence.
Well, I suppose one thing I would say, you know, that we're talking about a relationship between the Nimāna and Kaya and the Dharmakāya. So what I was trying to point to a bit this morning was that she... Yes, there is us moving in that direction towards the Dharmakāya through practice, through puja, through imagination, through kind of cultural activity. And, of course, the other side of it is that the Dharmakāya is trying to manifest and kind of come into embodied, into reach. And this is... we talk about this in terms of grace.
Mm.
You know, so there's the grace of the Buddhas, the grace waves of the Buddha, particularly evoked Sutra of Golden Light, where there's this sort of beating drum which is emanating these waves of grace coming out of the ineffable and impacting on us here. So I think there's very much important to, I think imagination opens us into a space, but then actually, if it's actually imagination, then that being, that evocation, has its own life, which we then come into, which starts to communicate itself in its, from its own space, from it in its own way. So I think what's really interesting about an imaginative engagement with kind of visualization and reflection is that at some point it takes off and starts to have its own life, which we then engage in or receive, actually. Mm. And I think if you're kind of a poet or an artist in any way, you kind of know that moment where you're kind of pushing from your end and then something starts to come from the other side, from the other end of the dialogue or the other end of the conversation in some way, and it starts to speak and sort of take its own form. So I think it's really important to kind of recognise that there's two ends to the to puja, to our own practice, that yes, we are actively moving towards, but you know, the Buddha wants to say hello, you know, he's kind of desperate to kind of get a word in edgeways around all our sort of activity, really.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think that's an important element in this discussion on Sambhogakaya.
Yeah, yeah. You've reminded me of one of the interviews I did that was done for this project, talking to different order members about their practice, was an interview with Shraddha Vajri, who's a young Indian order member, and she's a very devoted follower of Padmasambhava. And there's a wonderful bit in her interview where she's talking about her relationship with Padmasambhava, and she's got a lot of energy. There was an extract I played one night on Sangha night where she was talking about how when she was a child, she says, I was an anger girl. I was angry about the world. I wanted to change the world. And she's got this energy, you know, she's a black belt in karate and she's really kind of there when she's there. And she says, this other bit, she said, and I say to Padmasambhava, you don't have a body, I have a body, you need to come, I've got a body. if you're going to act in the world, you need to. And it's just, she's really got faith in that. And there was just something so direct about that. Yeah. I think it was, it's exactly what you're saying. Yeah, I think, I mean, inherent in any talk of imagination is receptivity, isn't it? I think that's it. It's not a sense of fabrication and making things up. It's creating a space into which inspiration, Adishtana, grace waves is a translation of Adishtana again, of blessings, the way that can flow in and through us and nourish us, and that flows out as well. Then there's that sense of overflowing, I think, when you've received, you want to give. Yeah.
I suppose you could also talk about it in terms of the language of going beyond the self, which is part of the language that Buddhism uses. This idea that our self, all the sort of constructs that we have, you know, the ideas, the stories about who we are, sort of making up our world. And yet Buddhism is saying that, you know, this is what you're trying to go beyond, these constructs that are limiting and stopping you from reaching that open dimension. But how can you use the self to go beyond the self? So I think the Sambhogakaya and this sort of, you know, tantric approach which came out of Mahayana Buddhism can address that question. So with the idea of, you know, there's this being like a Tara or a Padmasambhava or the Buddha in his archetypal form, is that being you, or is that being something other than you? And it can put you right on the edge of that question, and being on the edge of that question is a very good place to be from a Dharmic practice point of view. So yeah, this idea that you create something, you know, imaginatively, that comes out of the self, as Badger was saying, then it seems to be get met from somewhere else, as it were. And in the Sambhogakaya, which is often associated with the meditative state, and in fact all of these figures came out of meditation and appeared, you know, supposed to appear to people in meditation, from that meditative state, you're trying to take yourself to the edge of what is possible within the limitations of your experience, and to stand on the edge of that, and be receptive. So that, you know, in some ways, the idea of awakening in Buddhist spiritual life is a complicated idea. You know, how can you awaken to the truth of things if what you're trying to awaken from is this thing that you're using to try and awaken with? Does that make sense?
There's an interesting aspect there of the you could describe as the gravitational pull of the rational, and we're in a society that really, really values the rational and the reasonable, and has less tolerance, shall we say, of the non-rational. But actually, we are very much made up of the rational and the non-rational and the emotional, and it's very easy to get stuck in what is kind of rational and logical, and our sense of ourself and what's sensible in a mundane, day-to-day, sensible way pulls very, very strongly on us, and it can really kind of close us down, even to the beauty of the everyday, never mind, you know, the beauty of the transcendental. So actually consciously engaging in practices which enable us to enable that non-rational part of ourselves to respond is a very, very important aspect of Dharma practice. It's not saying let's ditch the rational. We need clarity, and we need, you know, we know that we're practicing for good rational reasons. There's suffering in the world, and there's an end to suffering, and there's a way to the end of suffering. But actually, in order to harness all our energies, we need to really acknowledge that there's something in us. Often we might describe it as a longing, or there's something that isn't this kind of fixed, familiar, self or selfhood. And it's a bit like trying to get chewing gum off your fingers, in a way. If you try to do it in a kind of rational kind of way, if you're trying to get somewhere, if there's something, all the time there's something you're trying to grasp, actually you're just making the problem. you're not actually transcending the difficulty, because actually the only way to go beyond the self is to let go, and that's a kind of an opening and a letting. It's not something you do, it's a non-doing. And you need to have all your energies flowing in that direction, in a way, to be able to let go. Now I'm interested in what either of you might say about where I've taken us.
Well, kind of, it's interesting. I suppose, yeah, the letting go, I do see that as sort of a very important part of practice. And from what you're both saying, really, that we do also engage, the will, and kind of we are trying to create a direction in our being, conscious direction in our being. But I suppose what came to mind for me was this whole notion of non-duality. You know, that actually, I was just thinking, start talking about Dharmakaya and the Mahakaya, kind of create a false dichotomy in a way. And actually, the Sambhogakaya seems to fit somehow into that sense of, avoiding those two. To see it either as too remote and abstract or too concrete, and actually there's something that falls in this, they sort of Dharma door, isn't it? That something just opens in that apparent dichotomy. Something opens up in amongst that, which is just direct. I don't know how to describe it even.
Well, it's a kind of middle way, isn't it?
Yeah, you could say it, middle way.
Well, I think actually the middle way is a really difficult thing to get to, because it's very easy to think the middle way is just in between two extremes, but in a way it's, following that idea of non-duality, it's neither. Even to the extent that you say self and beyond self are two ideas and extremes, because the mind that we're used to, the thinking mind, can only grasp things in dualities. We're kind of stuck to some extent within the prison of that way of thinking. But I think that's I think that's why these sorts of practices can be so useful, because I think they do take you to the edge of certainty. I've just been reading a book called The Edge of Certainty, actually, with that. And also it seems that the way that the Sambhogakaya manifests, or what we get attracted to, seems important and personal as well. So we get attracted to the figure of Tara, as certainly this Indian friend, attracted to Padmasambhava. And it seems in some way we find what we need within that. And it's said there are as many figures in the Sambhogakaya as there are human beings, because all of our needs are different and we're met in all sorts of different ways. And it's quite interesting, if you do something like visualization practice, sometimes you're following a form and you're meditating on a form, but then the figure seems to kind of show up, not necessarily in the way that you were trying to do it, in some ways, Sangharakshita has talked about it as being, I think, a conduit, that you create a conduit by creating a meditation practice where you visualise something, but that's not the meeting, in a way. That's the conduit, or the lightning conductor that you hope will be struck by the lightning. And when the lightning comes, it can come in a very different way to how you think.
I was just thinking, when Naravira was speaking, there's quite an important point in here that many of you may be familiar with, but it's really worth remembering, that we often talk in Buddhism about there being different kind of realms. And it's a particular language that suggests there is this kind of... for example, when we talk about the metta bhavana and the other practices associated with the metta bhavana, the karuna bhavana and the others, these four meditations that grow out of the loving kindness, they're known as the Brahma Viharas, or the sublime abodes. So there's that sense in which they're pointing to there being these kind of, quotes, other places that one can dwell. And it's an imaginative way of saying there are these other realms where we can experience ourselves, but actually they parallel states of consciousness which we can access through meditation. So there's realms of form, there's formless realms, and similarly in terms of dhyana states that we get into meditation, these higher states of consciousness, there's this sort of parallel in terms of our personal experience and what we cultivate in meditation, and the way that it's described in the tradition, where it's kind of objectified, if you like, and described as these different realms. And I think that's just quite... It's another thing where we're looking at, well, is it out there, is it in here? It's that kind of edge that we're travelling along, or hopefully reaching, so that we're going beyond our familiar territory.
Where you'd like to say something about puja.
I'm just wondering what it's time for. It's 5:20.
I was wondering if there were questions, if people wanted to sort of join in the discussion.
I wondered if we might need a little bit of time in smaller groups to see if there was anything to say about this with each other. Just, I'm just aware it's that kind of sleepy time of the afternoon.
Well, I think that might be a bit much, personally. I think we could just check. I mean, I suppose it's, I'm aware, yeah, the energy is kind of, you know, there's quite a lot of tired-looking people from this side of the... And just wondering what to do about that, whether whether it's too much, whether it's already too full up, or whether... Yeah.
Or if there are any questions.
Yes.
Well, there's no question, but I'm just delighted in hearing this conversation, actually, in being present and hearing the frankness and the clarity with which you're having a conversation, from which I'm learning all the time. It's very enjoyable to be here, just so you know that. Yeah. And, of course, it does make... I'm making a convince to myself, oh, I'll...
Oh no!
So much stuff. It's a delight, actually.
Yes, my echoes.
We'll come to you. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, as somebody who has no experience of these archetypal beings and things, how does one go about beginning a practice? Setting
a visualization, or is there a good book I should be reading to start with? What's the starting point for this?
Yeah.
Because
I've only ever experienced it in one
Sangha
night in Oxford, where somebody led a visualization.
Yeah. How do I get into it? Well, we don't. Usually, what in Tree Ratna, people start taking on a visualization practice at ordination. Sometimes before. Mm. I suppose the thinking behind that is probably it's getting you're getting to a point where you're forming sort of stronger connection, and also meditation practice might be a bit stronger, and so it's easier to kind of do something like a visualization. But there's no reason why one shouldn't. I mean, you can do, you know, simple things. I mean, there are some, you know, sort of understandings perhaps about doing the visualization so one doesn't kind of go down a bit of a wrong track with it. One of those is that we've always visualized or start a visualization with the blue sky. So you visualize a blue sky, and it's a really important part of the practice. So you could equate the blue sky with Shunyata, which was mentioned. I'll talk a bit about Shunyata tomorrow. So that's the idea that we don't sort of create a concrete, fixed entity out of that. Because if you did that, you could sort of start creating a kind of god figure. And there are no figures like that in Buddhism. There are no fixed figures like that in Buddhism. So the blue sky keeps that open dimension. Everything that manifests within the blue sky. So you might be visualizing a Tara, you visualize a lotus, you visualize a mat, and then you start visualizing the figure. And usually there's a mantra that goes with the figure. Sometimes the mantra comes down from the figure, down into your own heart. There's a syllable as well, so there's quite a lot to visualise. Well, the first visualisation practice I ever did was called the Manjugosha Stuti Sadhana, which is, it was really long. It had like these 13 verses that you had in Sadhana. It took me 2 hours to just do the meditation. But since then, Sangha Akshita has actually simplified a lot of the visualisation practices from there. The Tibetan forms that he received them in. And to that, just the blue sky, the figure, the mantra. And then at the end, the mantra goes back, everything is dissolved back into the blue sky, and then the blue sky itself disappears and you come back. Mm. Yeah. So that's basically the form of it. Yeah.
And that's just one way of coming into relationship with that realm, I think. I mean, I think the point about visualisation practices being something we take up after ordination is that they're on the basis of effective going for refuge. It's like that it's an aspect of going for refuge, actually having a daily practice and a relationship in that way. But actually, we're connecting with those figures all the time, you know, whether we do puja and certainly chanting mantras. Many of us chant mantras in all sorts of contexts in daily life. There's different ways of connecting with and calling on and forming relationships with the different archetypal figures, whether it's having images. And the absolute classic books on this are the ones by Vasantra. Mm. So originally it was one book called Meeting the Buddhas, but now it's three. It's the same content. So Meeting the Buddhas, Meeting the Bodhisattvas, and Guide to the Tantric Deities. And all the different figures are in there, and there are illustrations. And really a whole wealth. He spent a long time, he was at Gukiloka in Spain at the retreat centre when he wrote it, wasn't he? And he was meditating on the figures and writing the books, and they're a really fantastic evocation of many, many of those figures in the archetypal realm. Yeah.
So reading all those books could be... Yeah.
And I'd also like to just challenge you a bit, saying that you've got no experience of this realm, because actually I believe it's a completely natural thing that we have access to all the time, that we haven't kind of, it's not formulated in this way, but I can't believe you haven't sort of sat in nature and felt the presence of something. And that is sadhana, is kind of what we're talking about, but we're talking about a more conscious building of that kind of conditions to evoke that feeling or that kind of presence. So it's not that you haven't, you know, you don't know anything about it, because actually I think you do. Actually, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to deny your experience, by the way. I'm just saying, actually, if you look into it a bit more, you'll see that actually you do know it. What we're talking about, or Naravira was talking there, was a very specific way of creating the conditions to access something. But actually, that is a useful form, but it's not the only way that these things can become visible in our lives.
I think
you've done puja before.
Yeah, I have. I think maybe I didn't phrase this very clearly. The reason I asked is because I feel lots of resonance with what I mean is I don't have any knowledge of, I haven't done that reading, I haven't got a sense of who these Bodhisattvas might be. I don't really feel comfortable with that word. So it is in these terms that it's totally fresh.
Because you're a storyteller, and it's the realm where inspired stories come from.
An archetypist.
I always find it fascinating how popular archetypes are. So we live in this very rationalistic, materialistic society, and yet people flock to the cinema, probably download it these days, but all sorts of stories, very archetypal stories, you know, Lord of the Rings and Star Wars has been massive, you know, it's a very, very archetypal story. People are still very attracted to this world. But if you ask them, you know, they'd probably put up some rational barrier against it.
And I guess the important point there is that all these archetypes, this is obvious, but I'll say it because it's important, there's a value system behind them, and depending on the archetypes that you're imbibing, depending on what cinema you're watching or whatever, you're imbibing, you're kind of nourishing, it's back to food again in a way, it's like you're nourishing yourself with that value system. So what we're talking about here specifically is the dharmic dimension of that, and obviously there's loads and loads of other dimensions, and some of those are really helpful and incredibly nourishing and valuable, and some of them will poison your mind.
You could have negative myths, as it were.
So it's just remembering there's that choice to be made. I have a suggestion. I mean, I don't know if there's any more questions. My suggestion was that we were going to move into a bit of a look at how this realm of the Sambhogakaya manifests through the puja, and we're going to be doing a classic sevenfold puja tonight. So I was going to suggest, if you'd like to stay for another 20 minutes or so and hear about that, please do. And actually, if you're full and you need to go and walk in the garden before dinner or do whatever you need to do, that's also the open offer. So can I ask, how many people have never done a sevenfold puja before? So some of you have got some experience. Some people have got loads of experience. So puja means worship. And one of the things I like to remember when we use this word worship, because it's one of those words that's got lots of connotations from lots of different cultures, is that the etymology, the origin of the word, is worthship. It's to do with focusing our minds on what we feel has worth. And as we've been saying, it's very much taking us into a kind of archetypal realm that is imbued with the values of the Dharma. It's imbued with the three jewels. That's what we're really valuing when we practice puja. It's a very classic form that moves through different stages. It's a kind of progression that takes us more deeply into relationship with the three jewels. And the puja that we practice comes from a text that was written in India in about the 8th century by Shantideva called the Bodhicharyavatara, which is a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So the Bodhisattva is somebody who's vowed to gain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And it's a text that's really helping us to cultivate that aspiration for ourselves. Okay, pause. See what either of you want to say about that. So far, so good. It's great. I mean, one of the things I really love is when you... Well, I was talking about this earlier when we were sitting under the tree about getting different translations of a different text. So you get like a hologram. And I really love the way that you talk to different people in the order, and you've got these resonant but different angles. It's incredibly enriching, I think.
It was hologram, quite like that, isn't it?
That's the vision. Meanwhile, back at the puja. So, in a way, so the puja is very much a practice that comes from the Mahayana, from this flowering into imagination, into the where the whole Sambhogakaya comes in, and it can be as vivid as you let it. You know, you can sit in a puja, recite the words, and kind of they can go past. And they may or may not have some effect. You can actually recognise that we're stepping into a cosmic drama when we take part in puja. There are all sorts of realms, beings, dimensions. We can imaginatively prepare ourselves for the puja if we wish. I have a friend who... for years she's had this whole thing of as soon as she arrives in the shrine room, she's got a host of bodhisattvas arriving and filling up around the edges of the shrine room, and the different figures are kind of taking their places, ready to be worshipped. And it's there's as much in it as your imagination would like to create, in a way. Well, this morning when he introduced the Tiratnavandana, Sangadeva was particularly drawing out that line that means, my worship flows unceasingly. And it's like that sense of flowing appreciation and energy in the direction of this archetypal realm. And as we've been saying, it actually then gives it the opportunity to communicate back to us, because we've actually become receptive. And we start with giant flowers the size of cartwheels. You may not realise this, but that's actually what's in the first bit. When we say with Mandarava, Mandarava is a kind of flower, and it's these huge, great big flowers. With Mandarava, blue lotus and jasmine. And with all flowers pleasing and fragrant, and with garlands skillfully woven, I pay honour to the princes of the sages. So immediately we've got this beautiful, colourful, magical, expansive realms of offerings. I offer them lamps encrusted with jewels, festooned with golden lotus. On the paving sprinkled with perfume, I scatter handfuls of beautiful flowers. It's this great abundance. It's a bit much, really. And I think one of the things about this whole Samboga Kaya realm is that if we let it, it can just overwhelm our rational minds. We can't pin it down. We just have to sort of let it have an effect on us. So we're very much starting, with worship. And then, this is a whistle stop tour, by the way. And if I miss your favourite bit, do chip in. That's the first stage. And then traditionally we go to chanting the mantra of Avalokiteshvara. Sometimes it's a different mantra. But in the classic puja, as we're doing tonight, we're invoking Avalokiteshvara, who is the Bodhisattva of compassion. So it's he's an archetypal embodiment of compassion. And Avalokiteshvara is also the symbol of our order, of the Triratna Buddhist order, because Avalokiteshvara has 1,000 arms, all the better to help in different ways in the world. And when the order was first started, Sangharakshita had this vision of it being like an archetypal being with 1,000 arms, and at that point it probably had 12 members. And the thought of having 1,000 was kind of rich beyond dreams of avarice. Actually, we've got more than 2,000 order members all across the world now. But this image of the compassionate activity of the order in this archetype of Avalokiteshvara. So this, the Avalokiteshvara mantra is the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. Mani Padme, jewel in the lotus. Actually, I was talking earlier about this mudra. This is a gesture that a lot of us do. And actually, you can see this as being like the jewel in the lotus. The preciousness that can unfold. So we chant the Avalokiteshvara mantra, and just you can have this image of this thousand-armed. I meant to bring a picture in, actually. Thousand-armed bodhisattva being. So we've worshipped, we've invoked Avalokiteshvara, and at that point we have the opportunity to come up and make offerings to the shrine. Then we have salutation, and again it's cosmic, isn't it? As many atoms as there are in the 1,000,000,000 worlds, so many times I make reverent salutation to all the Buddhas of the three eras, to the Siddharma, and to the excellent community of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I pay homage to all the shrines and places in which the Bodhisattvas have been. So again, just realms beyond realms. I make profound obeisance to the Buddhas and those to whom respectful salutation is due. So we're very much kind of setting the scene. We're in this great vast mythic landscape. And then we go for refuge. We've created the realm, and then we bring ourselves into it. This very day, I go for my refuge. This is the third section of the puja. I go for my refuge to the powerful protectors whose purpose is to guard the universe. So what are they? Well, they're the archetypal embodiments of these qualities that are going to protect us. They're not some literal figure out there like a god. They're actually the embodiments of these energies, these skillful mental states. Mantra, it's interesting. In my mind, it connects with mantra. We talk about chant, we chant mantras, and the word mantra literally means protects the mind. It's an act that we can do that has a protecting effect on the mind. So in a way, these protectors are like these archetypal embodiments of those qualities of protection. We invoke them. So going for refuge. Powerful protectors whose purpose is to guard the universe, the mighty conquerors who overcome suffering everywhere. And again, this was something that came up just now when we were talking about the Tiratna Vandana and this word jaya, victory. Somebody was quite surprised it was associated with Buddhism, but it's like, no, it's a victory over unskillfulness, it's a victory over the causes of suffering. And actually, that takes energy, that takes commitment, it is something to be celebrated. So we go for refuge, and then we chant the refuges and precepts in Pali, one of those things that connects us right across the world and also right back through time. So we've got this, again, it's another thing that has these many dimensions. If our imagination lets us remember to engage with that. And it's interesting, because when we've done that, when we've recited the refuges and precepts, we've made that commitment to go for refuge, it's a natural unfolding in the puja that then actually we become aware, having stated our ideal, you could say, we become aware of where we don't quite reach that, where we've fallen short, and that's where we have this section on confession. So this is relating to our ethical practice. It's relating to this fact that, yes, we aspire to go for refuge, and there are these habits, these defilements that hold us back. So we're in this territory of the power of the white seed that Badra was talking about this morning with ethical practice. It's like we can gather skillful acts, which are white seeds, which can help us on our way towards awakening, or we can keep stacking up the dark seeds, which actually are going to hold us back. With confession in Buddhism, it's an acknowledgement that we're just putting those things down. We don't need to hold on to them. It's not like there's a god that's going to give us absolution. The language in this section's quite strong. The evil that I have heaped up in my ignorance and foolishness. It's strong language, but it's strong language to meet the fact that actually our own unskillfulness causes us such pain and suffering and other people. In that sense, it is evil. It's not evil in the sense of existentially evil. It's just the fact that actually the suffering that it causes is evil. It's vile. And actually, the more we can acknowledge that and let go of it, the better. But it's strong. And if you've had conditioning in your past, in other religious contexts, actually sometimes this verse it can be very strong. So it's good to acknowledge that. And understand why we've got the language that we have. The evil that I have heaped up through my ignorance and foolishness, evil in the world of everyday experience, as well as evil and understanding and intelligence, all that I acknowledge to the protectors. Standing before them with hands raised in reverence and terrified of suffering, it's not being terrified of suffering in terms of divine retribution, it's karma. It's the law of karma. We can't escape the consequences of our own actions, but we can bring our actions into awareness, set them down, and that has a profoundly positive karmic effect, because we've replaced ignorance with awareness. So that's what's going on in that section. It's so important because I think sometimes, yeah, people find that a challenging section because it's freighted with other understandings. Yeah. Terrified of suffering, I pay salutations again and again. Another interesting line, may the leaders receive this kindly, just as it is with its many faults. What is not good, O protectors, I shall not do again. So the leaders, I mean, if we're going to have an inclination towards an authority projection, there's a good hook for it. These leaders, but they're kind of leaders. They're leaders in the way to awakening, aren't they? They're these embodiments. The embodiments, the qualities that are going to take us towards awakening. So in a sense, it's like we're letting go in that direction. We're just saying, yep, may they receive this, may we just let this go. Yeah. And I often think it's a bit like an exhalation, kind of a, yep, confession. And then it's almost like there's an inhalation, we come to the next stage, which is called rejoicing in merit. And it's like then there's space just to really expand. Yeah. I rejoice with delight in the good done by all beings through which they obtain rest with the end of suffering. May those who have suffered be happy. I rejoice in the release of beings from the sufferings of the rounds of existence. I rejoice in the nature of the Bodhisattva and the Buddha who are protectors. I rejoice in the arising of the will to enlightenment and the teaching, those oceans that bring happiness to all beings and are the abode of welfare of all beings. It's just sort of overflowing of kind of, yeah, the positive heart opening towards all that is to be rejoiced in the world. And, yeah, very much sympathetic joy resonating with the good done by all beings. Yeah. So, rejoicing in merit.
I really find that particular section really fascinating and important. It does feel like, one of the things I wanted to mention was that shame in Buddhism has seen to be a positive mental state. So it's actually this sense of that confession, if you really confess, not if you kind of indulge, but if you really confess something that you really want to put down and let go, that kind of the release from actually naming something that you really are aware of, which is trapping you in a particular mode, can be so helpful to really, particularly, you know, to do it within the context, in a ritual context or within somewhere where you can really be fully open. It's such a relief to really acknowledge one's shame about one's actions. And that natural, because shame, I know it's got, you know, it's quite a difficult, can kind of shrink us and make us go into isolation, but actually if we articulate our things that we feel ashamed of or our actions, there's such a release there, which is that then that opening out into the rejoicing. It's almost as if putting down that what we've been shamed by, then it just naturally opens us, opens our heart into that next phase of the puja. And it's, I kind of feel, gives me a lot of hope and faith, I suppose, in practice, that actually I can really own my own skillfulness and kind of name it. There is a support to actually begin to release from it and put it down, and that opens the heart, opens the me, my being, back into the world again. I don't have to. Shame tends to kind of do that, and through confession is that opening, that reopening. So I think it's a really important part of the puja, that phase.
So how do you do that? You write something down and you burn it, or what?
That's one way. That is a traditional way of doing it. Or find somebody you really trust and talk to them. That's another way.
Sometimes we have specific confession pujas when we'll have a bowl on the shrine and you can write things down and put them in the bowl. But you can also imaginatively offer them to the shrine. Yeah, we're not going to have a bowl or anything tonight, but you can imagine placing them at the foot of the Buddha to let them go. Yeah.
I think it's quite important that if you are, for instance, going to talk to somebody and to confess something, that it's somebody, and this sort of goes without saying, but you know, somebody that you really trust and somebody who can receive it. So, you know, I think you can have the experience of confessing something and not having it received, and that can be quite difficult and not very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Be a bit more brief in taking us through to it. No, it's fine. I think that is really important. Mm. And I think what I was going to say following on from Badra is that having made the confessions and allowed that joy to arise, actually we're then really receptive. It's like there's a sense of purification and receptivity. And what happens then is the next section, we ask for a teaching, entreaty and supplication. Entreating them with folded hands, I entreat,
saluting them
with folded hands. I entreat the Buddhas in all the quarters. May they make shine the lamp of the Dharma for those wandering in the suffering of delusion. So, yeah, really asking for a teaching. After which, the teaching arrives. Now, what we often do and what we'll do tonight is we have a reading immediately after that, which is a teaching, usually from the Buddha. So I'll tell you what that is later on. And then we recite in unison the Heart Sutra. So the Heart Sutra, in a way, is the pithiest, well, it's what it says in a way, it's the heart, the heart of the Buddha's wisdom teachings. It comes from the perfection of wisdom. You're going to say a bit about it tomorrow, aren't you?
Yeah.
So in a way, it's a bit like, you could say, it's probably arguable, but you could say it's almost like the heart sutra is a bit like, it is an evocation of the Dhammapada. Yeah. And then having done all that, we've made loads of merit, loads of positive karma. So we have this transference of merit and self-surrender section, which I'm sure everybody's come across before. And there's that, very much that sense of interconnectedness with it, that we're not just doing it for ourselves, but we're doing it for the sake of all beings. And we want to really dedicate that merit for the sake of all beings. So the altruistic dimension's right in there. We're not just doing it for ourselves. And again, in the classic puja that we're doing tonight, we then call on Padmasambhava. As Bhadra said this morning, Padmasambhava is often known as the second Buddha. He's the one who established the Dharma in Tibet. And he's particularly renowned for taming and transforming demons. And he's also got a particular connection, or rather Sangharakshita has a particular connection with Padmasambhava. One of his teachers gave him the name Urgyen, which is a reference to the land in which Padmasambhava was born. And I think there's that sense of anybody who's kind of taking the Dharma to establish the Dharma in a new land has a connection with Padmasambhava. And finally, we recite in call and response a series of mantras which are described as the concluding mantras, and they evoke different figures who are different embodiments of enlightened energy. And it's a bit like, in a way, acknowledging that they're now present.
And they appear in the Sambhogakaya.
And they all appear in the Sambhogakaya.
As it were.
Yeah. So make sure I get them in the right order. We invoke Avalokiteshvara, who I've already mentioned. We invoke Manjushri, who's the one with the sword. He's connected with... It's the sword that cuts into one, actually. I won't say any more about him. Wisdom. Manjushri is associated with wisdom. Vajrapani, very much associated with energy. There's loads we could say about these, but anyway. Tara, we've talked about. Amitabha, who we're about to start exploring on Sangha night, who dwells in the Western realm, associated with meditation, loving kindness, friendship. The Shakyamuni mantra, so that's connecting us back with the historical Buddha, right in here. And then Padmasambhava mantra again. And then the mantra of the Pranyaparamita, of the perfection of wisdom. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone, altogether beyond, all is well. Most mantras don't really translate, but that one has a translation. And you're going to say more about that tomorrow, aren't you?
Yeah, and tomorrow night we're going to do a Pranyaparamita puja.
Yeah. And finally, the puja tonight will end with the three shanti. Chants of Shanti, which means peace. Yeah. So that will be our journey for tonight, and that will be us stepping more into the Sambhogakaya.